I'm Evan Kleinman of Angelique Cafe, and this is Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Well, if thoughts of Thanksgiving kind of make you sick, you need to find something else to do for the next hour. It's all about the Big Eat Fest next week, today on the show. For those not up to sacrificing a turkey this year, I'll tell you how to adopt one, and what the pilgrims really ate and wines to drink on the holiday. But first, let's go to the farmer's market to see what's in season this week.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. It is Thanksgiving week, and this is the biggest day of the year for the Wednesday Farmers Market. Everybody has special recipes. There's lots of fantastic food. Right now we're visiting with Jean-François Metinier, and he is the chef at La Cachette. And Jean-François, as usual, is running around shopping, but he is going to share with us that he's going to do something sort of traditional for his Thanksgiving.
We do a corn chowder, and after we have a turkey with a chestnuts and a green chard stuffing. After that, we do a pecan pie with a chestnut rum ice cream.
Chestnut rum ice cream on the pecan pie.
Yeah.
Oh. So now we have chestnuts at the market. Are you going to be buying them fresh, roasting
them
yourself,
them
all that stuff? Yeah. Tell us again. Now, how are you going to cook? Do you boil them or do you roast them?
We roast them first, and after we boil them in milk, and we finish them with a little syrup. Syrup with vanilla.
Oh, vanilla syrup in the milk. So after you roast them, you take them out of the shell, and then they have that little kind of skin. Do you take that off before you put them in the milk?
Yeah.
Now, is corn something traditional in French menus at this time
no.
of year?
No. In France, corn, they use it to feed animals. They don't really... And you find them in cans. You don't find fresh corn around. My mom, when she came here, said, oh, you eat fresh corn. She was very surprised.
Because it's animal food.
We made a white sauce mixed with yellow corn, which is kind of French sauce. Mixed with, you know, yellow corn is more American. It's kind of a French-American Thanksgiving.
Oh, I love corn. Well, corn is, of course, one of our traditional foods here. And we're so fortunate in California, we do have corn all the way till Thanksgiving. But you are going to do a main course turkey with the chestnut chard stuffing.
Yes, it's delicious.
How do you do that?
It's chestnut, chard, ground turkey meat, little breadcrumbs, and a little garlic and herbs. And just baked in the oven. We bake it separately. Now, after so many years, we tried the turkey stuff, nut stuff. Now we roast the turkey with herbs inside, without the stuffing, and we do the stuffing separate. And anyway, it works fantastic.
Do you have to braise the chard first before you add it to the chestnut before you put
it in? We braise the stems and we boil the leaves.
Okay, and then put them all together and then bake them with all these wonderful herbs and onions.
Yeah, it's delicious. And a tiny little bit of cinnamon.
That's going to be
good. That's
right. Are you taking reservations at the restaurant
for
Thanksgiving?
Yes,
right. What's the number and where can people call?
310-470-4992.
That was Jean-François Metinier. He is the chef at La Cachette. And you can see he's fusing a French and American traditional foods here for Thanksgiving, our big food day. We love the little French touches, and boy, that rum chestnut ice cream sounds so good. Okay, thanks so much, Jean-François.
You're welcome.
For Thanksgiving, everybody tries to come up with the most interesting side dish they can possibly bring to dinner. And we're talking with Mary Sue Milliken from Border Grill. And Mary Sue, of course, has got tons of creative ideas. She's at the market, and she's shopping for probably one of the least respected vegetables on the market. And what are you going to do to make this vegetable fabulous, Mary Sue?
Well, Susan and I have always taken it upon ourselves to take vegetables like rutabagas and, you know, parsnips and turnips and weird things that people always say, well, I'll eat anything, but I don't eat those. Well, how many times have you heard that about Brussels sprouts?
Every day.
I'll eat anything, but I don't eat Brussels sprouts. So what we do to Brussels sprouts, and people become addicts for these. It's so simple. We did it at City Restaurant for 20 years. But you just slice them in half and shred them up as finely as you can. You could use your food processor. You could use a little mandolin type thing or one of those Japanese Benriner. They're the best. Really, really, really thin. And then you take a big, wide skillet. Get it nice and warm, add a little, I usually put half butter, half olive oil in there, throw the shredded Brussels sprouts in and saute them really quickly, a little salt, a little pepper, a little tiny squeeze of fresh lime at the end. They're irresistible.
That's it.
That's it. Nothing to it. And I'll tell you, even my kids, They both love them.
Well, lots of times Brussels sprouts are little hosts for many, many aphids. So you have to wash them a lot. And you actually sometimes have to peel off some of the... Do you ever peel off any of the outer leaves?
Absolutely. Okay. And I'm a real freak for those aphids. I don't want to... I mean, I know they're extra added protein, but I don't really want to eat them. So I look at them pretty carefully. And, you know, now that I'm getting older, I got to wear my glasses. I usually just pare them down on the outside leaves until I'm pretty sure there's no more inhabitants. And then just shred them up.
Okay.
Usually I do it with a knife because I'm kind of, you know, I like to hand cut everything. But I know a lot of people, you know, haven't been cooking for 30 years, so they might want to use their mandolin or their food processor. It'll work fine as long as they're just nicely thinly sliced, so a real fine shred. And they cook quickly.
Right. And I can imagine it'd be real important not to cook them too much.
Yeah. That's what everybody's mom did. That's why there's so many Brussels sprout haters out there in the world, because they all their moms just cooked them, you know, they put them on with the turkey in the morning, and then, you know, yuck.
And the flavor after they've cooked too long, it just gets that kind of, I don't know,
cabbagey
flavor, right?
Yeah,
right.
Just an old cabbagey flavor that's not so delicious. So I think that's where a lot of the turnoff came from.
All right, Mary Sue, thanks so much.
Okay,
Happy Thanksgiving to you, too. That was Mary Sue Milliken, and she is trying to resurrect the lowly Brussels sprout to a position of status at the table. The Saturday Santa Monica Farmers Market downtown is going to be closed the Saturday after Thanksgiving. The Pico Market will be open the Saturday after Thanksgiving, as will the Sunday Main Street Market. The only closure that will be in effect for the holidays before Christmas will be the Saturday downtown Farmers Market. It will be closed the Saturday after Thanksgiving. From everyone here at the Farmers Market, our staff, and all of our farmers, we wish every one of you a very, very happy Thanksgiving. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
There's so much nostalgia around Thanksgiving. There's the big table, the abundant and delicious food, the laughter and the joy, but usually that's on a commercial. In reality, there's odd family tensions, undercooked turkey, and pants that have become way too tight from all the nervous eating. A good remedy for the negatives associated with family gatherings is a nice bottle of wine. I've got suggestions for your turkey table when Good Food returns. Before Thanksgiving, the discussions among family members are endless. Which stuffing are we making? Bread stuffing or rice stuffing? Who's making the turkey? Is it being brined? How many veggie sides? Yams or russets? Mashed or roasted? It's funny how what wine is being served doesn't seem to be high on the list very often. So once again, we turn to Robert Wajness from Wine Expo in Santa Monica for tips on what to serve at the groaning board this year.
The groaning board. I love that.
Well, it is. It's like the American groaning board. And it seems like it's a meal just so perfect for great wine.
Well, it's interesting because your average guy who's really into wine, and it's always a guy at this point, wants to bust out the big stuff. He wants to bring the huge Chardonnays and the big Cabernets and the, you know, monster Turley Zinfandels and all this. But you have to think about, you're going to eat a lot. You're going to eat a lot for a long time. And then there's what food you're eating. And so I like to start with things that are lighter. One thing we've discovered recently is a pear cider from Normandy to serve instead of champagne or even Prosecco.
That's a great idea.
Yeah, the great thing is it tastes just like biting into a fresh pear. It's not sweet. It's just fruit level, but it's only 3% alcohol. So while everybody's standing around waiting for things, you know, turkey to come out of the oven and all this and that, instead of pounding 3 or 4 glasses of champagne or Prosecco at 12 to 13% alcohol, you drink this. So that's my number one tip, is get something low in alcohol as a starter, which could include a nice cider. You can get apple or pear ones. You can get them from France and from England and some from the United States. Also Vino Verde from Portugal, dry, crisp, 9% alcohol.
What's interesting to me about all the flavors of the beverages that you're describing is it seems like they would also be particularly good for the fruit component that always is very much in evidence.
Oh, yeah.
In
but I'm more suggesting these for the starters and when people are sitting around snacking on all the little things that are out. You know, yes, if someone doesn't want to drink red wine, those will follow through beautifully for exactly that reason with the fruit stuff. But now we get into the main course, and it gets really interesting because roast birds of any sort, be it chicken, duck, turkey, classic no-brainer, any wine is good with it. But where we get into it in Thanksgiving is what's in Granny's secret stuffing? Is there lots of sage? I'm from the South. We use oysters. Is there salt? Is there cumin? Things like that. And then the real culprit that gets interesting with wine is cranberry sauce. Because cranberry sauce is the only food I can think of other than really dark chocolate that's more tannic than your average Howell Mountain Cabernet. So you do not want to hit that with more tannic wine, which includes both barrel fermented white wines, which is your typical California Chardonnays, or big tannic Cabernets or Syrahs or Zinfandels. You want to come in under the radar with something like a Beaujolais. Beaujolais that underneath the name says something like Fleury or Moulin Avant. These are villages. And look for some quality importer like Kermit Lynch or Neil Rosenthal. If you go to a nice wine shop and ask them, do you have some good Beaujolais? I don't want some Nouveau. They'll have one. Also, because we specialize in Italian wines, we bring in a Novello, which is a similar wine from Italy that is actually good and quite inexpensive. And the reason I recommend these wines is that they have lots of fruit flavor, lots of conviviality factor. They're medium alcohol, 11-12%, and almost no tannin because you don't want that astringency. You've got enough astringency on the table already.
So what stuffings provide a unique challenge of matching?
Artichokes are a big problem. You know what merlotons are?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, that's a southern
chayote
thing. Chayote. Yeah, that's a southern thing. Those can be a problem for the same reason. They both have some sort of element in them that immediately turns tannic acid, which is the astringent part of wine, into a metallic bitter flavor on your tongue. Asparagus can do this too, but not as much. But artichokes are a real culprit. So if you're going to do that, and I encourage you, make the food, just use a wine that has less tannin, more fruit. Other examples could be the very fruity side of the Pinot Noir. We really like a grape variety from eastern Italy called Lacrima di Moro d'Alba, the Tears of the Hills of Alba.
Such a great name.
Yeah, that smells like raspberries, and we actually once put in our newsletter that the dessert wine version of it was evidently a way to freebase wild raspberries. Then another thing that people don't think about is dessert. And what I love to do is to get some chillable white dessert wine. It could be Moscato d'Asti, which, again, is low in alcohol and light and fresh and fairly affordable, or something fancy like Tokaj Azu from Hungary or Sauternes. Put a couple teaspoons of that in the whipped cream and put that on
the apple cobbler or the
pumpkin pie, and boy, does that really tie it together.
Wow, that's great. Thing. Now, what about people who, to them, Thanksgiving followed by much football – is a beer opportunity?
Oh, wonderful beers. First and foremost, I would say, again, for the same reason, stay away from all the my beer's hoppier than yours American microbrews. Not that there aren't American microbrews that are malty and rich and good with food, but, you know, I love a lot of beers like Arrogant Bastard Ale and these kind of things, IPAs, but they're so hoppy
just going to get which means
weird.
Bitter.
For the same reason as tannic wines. But maltier beers like Scottish-style beers, Hefeweizen. Hefeweizen works fabulously.
What about all the Unibrews?
Unibrew, which is a Canadian brewery making Belgian-style ales. They make a couple things that could work. They make the Blanche de Chambly, which is a fabulous Belgian-style wit beer. And then they have a seasonal that has actual apple juice in it that could work fabulously. And they sometimes do a cherry one because you got to remember, it's a big meal. You need something refreshing.
So, Robert, once again, too wonderful. So much information. And we should mention that you can be found at Wine Expo, which is located at 2933 Santa Monica Boulevard in Santa Monica. We've been talking about suitable beverages like wines, ciders, and even some beers for Thanksgiving. Before we get too far into the holiday of Thanksgiving, I always wonder how this holiday started. We all learned the story of the dinner between the Indians and the Pilgrims. I think maybe popcorn was involved. But what were Puritans eating in 1621, and how much of what we eat today is from way back then? I found a historian to tell us the real story. That's when Good Food continues. many of us, Thanksgiving continues to be our favorite holiday. Maybe it's the secular nature of the holiday, the fact that we all celebrate together as a nation, and we all bring our own differences to the table. But where did the meal really come from, and what was at that first Thanksgiving table? Kathleen Curtin is a food historian who works for Plymouth Plantation. Her book is Giving Thanks. I'm so glad that you're here this morning.
It's wonderful to be with you. Thank you.
Could you refresh our memories? What was the event that we refer to as the first Thanksgiving, and in what year did it happen?
Sure. In 1621, we know from one letter that exists that William Bradford, who was the colonial governor, sent four men out shooting for geese and ducks, and they brought back as much as would last the company for a week. Somewhere along the way, Massasoit, who is one of the leaders of the Wampanoag, came, brought 90 men, and some deer. And what ensued were 3 days of feasting and diplomacy and celebration. And that has come to be called the First Thanksgiving.
I have to say that I don't think I ever really understood that, that it was a three-day-long feast of these two groups of people coming together.
There's a lot of mythology that's built up around that event. First of all, it wasn't even a Thanksgiving according to the English Puritans who celebrated it. They would have considered it a harvest celebration. They were two separate events that really weren't connected until historians connected them rather artificially in the 1800s.
Let's talk about what could have been on the table. For sure you knew there were waterfowl, and I imagine that wild turkeys were around. We just don't know if they had any for that particular period of feasting.
That's correct. Yeah, from the description that exists, it makes sense that they are waterfowl, so geese and ducks, the migratory birds. Turkeys were in the area, and both the Wampanoag and the English enjoyed eating them, so there's every likelihood that because it was a three-day event, they may have entered the menu at some point. Venison is a definite, because we know that Massasoit brought that, at least five deer. Pumpkins were commonplace in gardens, both the Wampanoag and the English, and largely root vegetables, things like parsnips and carrots and turnips, onions, leeks, cabbage. Those sort of more hardier fall vegetables would still have been in gardens. We don't think that they probably had the capability to make things like pies. And so while they loved pies, the English loved pies, they didn't have an oven. And I doubt that they had much wheat flour or butter by that time. So meat was definitely the hallmark of the meal.
Was there sugar yet in the colonies?
People probably brought sugar with them. They probably brought spice with them. I've recreated a 1621 harvest feast. I ended up by using a cup of sugar altogether. There's a classic sort of combination in the 17th century of a little vinegar and a little sugar and a brothy sauce that people liked very much. So that certainly would have been within the colony's resources.
What about the pumpkins? What do you think they did with the pumpkin?
Pumpkins, there's recipes in English herbals from the 1600s, and in some of these recipes, they take and thinly slice the pumpkin and fry it in butter and put sugar and spice on it, and it's really wonderful. But we also have more dishes typical to what we would assume a pumpkin dish to be.
Now, what about cranberries? If sugar was something that was in scarce supply, one imagines that the early colonists didn't really embrace something that was as tart as a cranberry.
They couldn't certainly make sweet sauces out of it or pies out of it, but they could embrace its natural tartness. In around 1640, they have sufficient supply of sugar that you start seeing references to sweeter dishes, and certainly cranberry sauce, as we would recognize it, boiled cranberries with lots of sugar, was possible by then. They talk about cranberry sauce being a lovely relish for meats, so something you ate alongside meat as we do today.
Do we know what the Wampanoags were doing with the cranberries?
There's a wonderful boiled bread that the Wampanoag make that may have had cranberries in it. They may have also been doing some drying of cranberries, cooking up with them as well, mixing them into some of their pottages and stews. They're such a good source of vitamin C nowadays for us that you have to wonder if the Wampanoag didn't recognize the health principles of them as well.
And, of course, we can't possibly think of a Thanksgiving without stuffings. Was stuffing there at that first Thanksgiving?
Bread stuffings were probably not possible, but they would have liked them. They had bread stuffings in England, and they tended to be a little bit more on the sweeter side with dried fruit and some sweet spices in them. Quite wonderful, really. I think if a 17th century English person from 1621 came forward into our Thanksgiving meal, they'd feel pretty comfortable. Kathleen, bring us forward to when this real version of the first feasting for the harvest time became Thanksgiving.
It's not a date you can pin down. It's more something that evolves. The English Puritans, the colonists who came to Plymouth, celebrated a religious Thanksgiving, which was a day spent in church. And somewhere along the line, you get a meal that sort of attaches to that Thanksgiving. And the first instance I see of that is in 1637 in Scituate. And then it just seems to gain momentum and speed. And by the end of the 1600s, what's happening is ministers and people are starting to call for an annual Thanksgiving that's held in the fall for general blessing. And little by little over time, the meal becomes the most important part of the day. And certainly the celebration of family and friends and reunions are all important parts of that too, right up until modern times.
And when did it actually become a nationally recognized holiday?
Well, there's lots of presidents who call for Thanksgiving throughout the history of early America, but it's Abraham Lincoln who creates the national holiday rather unintentionally. He's been harassed and harangued by the wonderful Sarah Josepha Hale, who wants Thanksgiving to be a national holiday. She's a Yankee, and she really sees that this holiday promotes domestic virtues of hearth and home. So she petitions Abraham Lincoln, and he calls the first day of Thanksgiving that becomes the annualized tradition. He doesn't say that every president afterwards has to call for one, but that's just the trend he starts. It's during FDR's presidency that the holiday becomes part of our laws, and the date of the holiday is chosen as that last Thursday in November, the fourth Thursday in November.
So interesting. Thank you, Kathleen.
You're very welcome. It makes me want to have turkey and stuffing and gravy right
now. soon.
Absolutely.
Kathleen Curtin is the food historian of the Plymouth Plantation in Plymouth, Massachusetts. It's a unique living history museum of the 17th century. Her book is Giving Thanks, Thanksgiving Recipes and History from Pilgrims to Pumpkin Pie. One thing I love about this holiday is that after all these years, it's still a day untouched by commercialism. There's nothing to buy for this day besides food, and the gifts you bring to others are all edible. One thing that gets overlooked, though, on a feast day is the hors d'oeuvre. It's unrealistic to not eat anything all day long while you're waiting for those darn turkeys to be finished. I'll be back next with some tips on creating hors d'oeuvre for Thursday's meal. That's up next on Good Food. Possible that this year just zipped by so fast. If you're like me, you're in shock that the holidays are nearly here. Are you ready to cope with some entertaining? You know you want to do it, you just sort of dread thinking about it. But as they are saying these days, no worries. We have Abby Dodge here to help us get in the groove. Abby is a contributing editor for Fine Cooking Magazine, and she's the author of The Weekend Baker. She wants to help us make some simple hors d'oeuvres for the holidays. Okay, so what are we making?
Well, we're going to talk about something a little bit old-fashioned, and you're going to go, oh, Abby, God, this is so passé. But let's talk about mini quiches.
Now, you know what? I have to tell you that I love quiche, and I think that people have so given up on it that when they get it at a party, they get eaten before anything.
I am one of those people. I went to a party this summer, you know, kind of a beachy thing, but they were serving warm lobster. They called them cobblers, but they were mini quiches and they were lobsters. And I went wild over these things.
You mentioned that these particular people called them cobblers, and I've seen them in recipes being called mini tarts. Why don't you first tell us what are the elements of a quiche?
The basis of a quiche, it's basically an egg custard. There's egg and there's some sort of cream. Maybe it's a half and half, which I think lends just enough deliciousness to make it worthwhile using that half and half. Some recipes will call for heavy cream. Some will also just use milk. They are somewhat interchangeable, but I'd go with the half and half on that. And then, of course, there's cheese. So you have eggs, milk, and cheese. From there, you can really develop the recipes as you like and add things in, like kind of the classic quiche Lorraine has bacon in it. I personally love that classic one. But you could go spinach. You could go lobster like we were talking about.
Now,
you
I'm curious to know, when they did the lobster, was it like one nice clump in every tiny little quichelet, or did they chop it up very fine?
I love the term quichelet. Perfect. What they did with the lobster was they chopped it up not so fine that it was mealy, but just enough so that you were doing a two-biter in that quichelet. And in each bite, you weren't fighting for the ingredients and they weren't dripping down your chin and onto your pretty little party dress.
Now, when I think of a cobbler, I think of a topping. Was there something on top of it? Did they put a crumble or just a little bit more dough on top?
They were using just a regular pâte brisée, you know, a regular pie crust. And they took some of the extra dough and crumbled it just ever so slightly on top.
So I know already people are rolling their eyes thinking, oh, yeah, I'm going to sit and roll out dough and mold it into tiny little forms.
Yeah. And keep in mind, you don't want to do these recipes on a weeknight when you're jammed and the kids are calling and you're late home from work. You want to do this on a Saturday afternoon or if you get home from work early on a Thursday night and you can pour yourself a glass of wine and use phyllo dough. You can even use prepared pie crusts brought to room temperature. And it's easy from there. It's simple rolling out. And yeah, they're little mini tart pans. But if you're one of those bakers, you know, I'm a baker, have a tart tamper at home.
You have a tart tamper in that size?
Evan, doesn't everybody have a tart tamper in that
size? Okay, so describe what that does.
Basically, what it does is it's a wooden dowel that's just the right size for these mini tarts. And you can also get one that has two ends, one that's good for regular size muffin cups and one that's good for the minis. And it basically just taps down the dough and helps you spread the dough out more evenly around the muffin tin, no matter what size.
So now that we've sort of plumbed the depths of quichelets, what else do you have up your sleeve for an easy hors d'oeuvre?
Well, again, going along on the same sort of idea that we're going to try and take some shortcuts and use a great vehicle, phyllo dough or phyllo dough is a wonderful thing and is very easy to work with. You can make wonderful, maybe fill them with spinach, feta, and sun-dried tomatoes. You can even add some olives in there if you'd like to, maybe some Kalamata olives. And it's just wonderful because then you can fold them up into little triangles. We've all had these. We store them in the freezer unbaked. Then they're ready to go. You can, you know, make six dozen now of the little triangles. And by Christmas time, you know, a dozen here, a dozen there, you're all set and you're going to look like a genius.
Do you layer them with wax paper in between layers in like a little sort of pseudo Tupperware or actual Tupperware?
Yes. What I suggest doing, much like my suggestions for freezing cookie dough, shape the triangles of the quichelets and uncooked, I lay them in the freezer and I stack them, as you said, on cookie sheets if I need to create more space in the freezer until they're frozen solid. Once they're frozen solid, you can do all kinds of things. You can lay them in the Tupperware-like containers with parchment or waxed paper in between. I know people just dump them into the Tupperware containers because, again, they're solid so that they're not going to break and they're not going to dismember themselves. People also have tremendous success with heavy-duty zipper-top bags. My one caution about the zipper-top bags is that I would suggest using two of them to really ensure that you're sealing in flavors and sealing out odors, although that sounds like a commercial for something.
And I have to just throw in my two cents about my favorite filling for phyllo dough triangles lately has been a little bit of goat cheese and a little bit of quince paste or guava paste.
Ooh, that sounds divine.
Well, as always, Abby, it's such fun having a conversation with you about cooking. Take care.
Thanks, Evan.
Abby Dodge is an editor at Fine Cooking Magazine. We'll have her recipes online at kcrw.com. Click on the Talk menu and scroll down to Good Food. She has a fantastic baking book out called The Weekend Baker. Before we go on talking about Thanksgiving, what about that poor turkey? About 45 million turkeys are sacrificed in the name of this holiday. If that idea sends you to your medicine cabinet, hold on. I may have a humane solution for you. You can adopt one. That's next on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. That time of year again, we're digging out the huge roasting pan and ironing the tablecloth, thumbing through recipes to plan our Thanksgiving feast. Well, I have to say that some are probably less than eager for this day to roll around. I'm talking, of course, about the turkeys. If you'd rather adopt a turkey than eat one, Tricia Ritterbush from Farm Sanctuary has just the program. So explain what Farm Sanctuary is.
Well, we are the nation's largest farm animal protection organization, and we've been around since 1986, and we work to expose and stop cruel practices of the food animal industry through research and investigations, legal and institutional reforms, public awareness projects like our Adopt a Turkey project, as well as youth education and direct rescue and refuge efforts. And we have sanctuaries in Watkins Glen, New York, and Orland, California. Our Adopt a Turkey project features 8 of our rescued turkeys, 4 at our New York shelter and 4 at our California shelter.
So there's only 8 available for adoption this year?
Yeah, every year we usually focus on just 8 turkeys. We actually have over 90 turkeys that live at our sanctuaries. But we try to feature turkeys that have come from different rescues and spread the wealth out between the two sanctuaries. And the $20 adoption, gift adoption, goes towards the care and feeding of all of the turkeys that live at our sanctuaries.
So it isn't the case where we get to adopt a turkey and bring it home with us?
Well, that's not necessarily true, because you can also do that. Home adoptions are another component of our Adopt a Turkey project. And home adopters, there are some criteria initially. They must be vegetarian or vegan and committed to providing lifelong care for their turkey friends. And we have about 6 different Turkey Express drop-offs scheduled for prior to Thanksgiving. And these will go to loving families and other sanctuaries that want to take care of turkeys.
Do you keep track of the turkeys you adopt out to make sure they haven't, you know, been felled by the Thanksgiving knife?
We do. Yes, we have a pretty arduous adoption application and process. It requires veterinary recommendations. We need to know what kind of environment you would be providing for the turkeys. We want to make sure that the kind of life that these turkeys are given would be of the same quality of life that we can offer them at our sanctuaries.
Now, give me an idea of a rescue that you you did this year. I heard that there were quite a few birds rescued from a Northwest cargo disaster.
Yes, we were able to bring 11 turkeys to our California sanctuary. Over 9,000 birds actually died after being improperly transported from Detroit to San Francisco to be sent to a factory breeding facility in Central California. Through the Peninsula Humane Society and SPCA, Farm Sanctuary was able to welcome 11 of the survivors to our Orland shelter, and we are recommending, along with the Peninsula Humane Society and SPCA, that Northwest Airlines be charged in this case. There were 11,000 birds in total that were being shipped. Unfortunately, when investigators came onto the scene, cargo workers were actually dumping boxes of these day-old baby birds, live ones amongst dead ones, into a trash compactor. So luckily, the investigators got there in time to rescue the birds that were still alive.
How did this happen? How does it happen that out of 11,000 birds being shipped, 9,000 of them die?
Well, unfortunately, they were improperly packed onto the flight. My understanding is that the turkey breeding facility that was shipping the birds had requested that they be put on two separate flights, and they were all put on one flight. Now, when traveling in the middle of August in such extreme temperatures, and unfortunately, thousands of birds are shipped every day in the United States via the U.S. Postal Service on planes and through the mail. And that is legal for that to happen. And I think a lot of people don't realize that as the turkey industry has consolidated, there are fewer and fewer hatching facilities and breeding facilities. Everything's becoming vertically integrated. So now birds are being transported via the air and via trucks for many hours throughout the U.S.
Let's take a trip back to Farm Sanctuary. Tell us a little bit about how your turkeys are treated. I understand that each year you actually do a feast for the turkeys.
Yes, we do. In fact, those feasts are coming up this weekend. On Saturday, we'll be inviting 250 people to our California shelter, where we will have a fully catered meal for them. It's a vegan feast for the people. And then everyone will walk up to the turkey barn, and we have a feeding of the turkeys ceremony, where we feed them cranberries and lettuce and squash and pumpkin pie. So people can get to meet these turkeys face-to-face and see what wonderful social creatures they are.
Well, I'm glad we had you back this year, Tricia. Take care.
Thank you so much for having me.
You can find the Farm Sanctuary online at farmsanctuary.com. Let's take a break from all this holiday stuff and go get some lunch. I'll be back with Good Food Omnivore Jonathan Gold with a restaurant suggestion. That's in 1 minute, right here on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Once again, it is that revered time in Good Food where we take you somewhere where you could go eat right now. And if you can't make it there right now, you'll just be salivating for the rest of the day. Our guide, of course, is our wonderful omnivore, Jonathan Gold, author of Counterintelligence, Where to Eat in the Real Los Angeles, and, of course, author of millions of counterintelligence columns in the LA Weekly. Are we having breakfast today?
We are having breakfast in Arcadia. It's a newish place called Noodle House that serves Northern Chinese breakfasts. And what Northern Chinese breakfasts are a bowl of soy milk. It's regular soy milk. It's plain. It's sweetened with a lot of sugar. Your first two bites, it's a little chalky. It's a little plain. And then you have another bite, and it's like, hey, there's something to this. And then there's like a fourth bite, and it's like, the soup is my God. With the soy milk, you have these long sort of twisted crullers, and the oil and the decadence and the heat of these freshly fried crullers that you get with the soy milk is a very nice complement to the plainness of the soy milk. Then if you want to get more Baroque, they have something they call the Tianjin pancake, which is to say a Chinese pancake sort of like a flour tortilla, which has been glazed on the outside with a little bit of scrambled egg, like a Bombay-style Frankie, to mix metaphors even more. Inside the pancake, they smear it with bean sauce, and they sprinkle it with scallions, and they wrap the crullers in it. So what...
Oh, my God. So it's a cruller burrito?
It's a cruller burrito.
With a tiny bit of egg.
With a little bit of egg.
Oh, gosh. I would love that.
And you have to be kind of liberal in your interpretation of breakfast to admit cruller burrito to the pantheon. But, you know, why not?
But, you know, that's like a perfect waking up late on a weekend, you know, you're still in transition, so you're going to eat it around like 12. That's like the perfect beginning.
It's excellent. And as long as you've twisted your mind around to the idea of having your cruller burrito for breakfast, you would probably also admit the flaky sesame buns stuffed with beef.
Oh, that sounds really good. Is the outside, the doughy part, a little sort of greasy too?
It's a little bit greasy. It's definitely made with, you know, everybody's favorite shortening. from our friend the
Grisco.
Pig.
Grisco? Oh, lard.
Yeah, lard. It's kind of crispy and it's a little bit soft in the middle. It's like a really good biscuit with sesame that somebody stuffed beef into.
So it sounds like a Chinese knish.
Exactly. But if you really want a Chinese knish, what is probably the single best dish in the restaurant is the pan-fried buns, which is to say little bao, like smaller than your usual bao. These baos are about the size of, oh, I don't know, lemons. And they're stuffed with pork, and they're fried on a griddle in the sort of fairy ring. There's eight of them that make a perfect circle. And when they're sizzled just right, which is about half the time, there's this wonderful crust that develops on the bottom, and some stray bits of starch go out, and there's sort of this scrim of fried batter. And they serve it upside down with the brown side up so that the hot part doesn't steam the dough too much and make it too soggy. Then you take that and you dip it in this sort of garlic soy sauce and you eat it and you're really happy. It's an interesting way of ordering here. People don't tend to speak a lot of English there. But especially if you're lucky enough to get Linda, who I think is the cook too, she'll come out and she'll beam at you and she'll start jabbing her finger at the dishes that she thinks you should have that day. And she's always right.
Okay, give us once again the name of the restaurant and the address.
The name of the restaurant is Noodle House, and it's at 42 West Las Tunas in Arcadia.
Thank you so much, Jonathan.
Thank you.
Get more of Jonathan Gold at the LA Weekly. He's the counterintelligence columnist and writes about food each week there. If growing your own food sounds romantic and you'd like to move your family out to the country, listen first to my next guest. He's a small farmer. He loves his cows, and he knows a lot about hay bales. Stay tuned to meet him next on Good Food. So ever since my first trip to Italy in the 70s, I've found myself to be semi-fascinated by hay bales. I've noticed how much they've changed over the years, and one day when I was whiling away some time web surfing, I found a blog entry on the Stonyfield Farm website about hay bales. It turns out that the gentleman writing the essay on hay is Jonathan Gates. His family's the third generation living on a certified organic dairy farm in Vermont. Jonathan farms with his wife, Karen, sons Benjamin, Justin, and Noah, and his parents, Howard and Mary. Every family member pitches in, and he supplies milk that goes into Stonyfield Farm yogurts and smoothies, among other things. So we convinced Jonathan to spend some time with us this morning. Welcome.
Thank you.
What's it like working with family on the farm?
It's just really a very rewarding experience, you know, working with my parents still, which is really something special, and now working with my wife and my children to have them out there helping me, it's a great experience. It's good for me. It's good for my children learning responsibility and what it means to work and put in a put in a good day's work when we need them to, and I just think it's a great place to raise kids, to be out working with animals, working with the land. Just gives them a really good start in their life.
Let's talk for a minute about your cows, because I feel like I know them. You have quite a few videos of them up on YouTube,
yeah,
which I love, because they're just, I mean, you go onto YouTube, you click on the video, and you see these beautiful Jersey cows with their big, beautiful eyes and eyelashes. How many cows do you have?
We milk about 60 cows in the milking herd, and then we also raise all our own replacements. And we have about
what does 40 that mean? Replacements.
Replacements. Well, once the calves are born, we raise them for 2 years until they're ready to have their first calf and go into the milking herd.
Because you have so few, do they all have names?
Oh yes, all our animals are registered, and they all have three names. The first is our registered prefix, which is Helmars, the name of the farm, and named after my father Howard and my mother Mary. And then the second name is whoever their dad was, whoever they were sired by. And the third name is the name we choose to give them.
So the really incredible, beautiful cow that you have one video where it just seemed like she really wanted to get close to the camera. What's her name?
Oh, gosh, I'd have to. Oh, which one is that? Because they're all so nosy. As soon as someone goes out in the barn, they're all around and seeing what's going on. I'd have to look and see who.
Tell me, are cows generally nosy? I mean, give us a sort of a cow personality profile.
Well, I think so. I mean, I have all different individuals in my dairy herd. I have ones that when you go out in the barn, they won't leave you alone. And I have other ones that are kind of skittish, and they'll stay away and be a little nervous. And, I just know their temperament. But in general, because we handle our animals a lot, we're around them a lot because of grazing in the summertime, we're moving them in and out of pasture, and we're always around them. And ours are very calm and quiet. I've had it remarked to me by a gentleman who comes to service our animals to get them pregnant, because we do all artificial insemination in our dairy herd. He said, I've never seen such a friendly herd of cows. You know, you'll go out and they'll all come around. And he said, it's not always the case. Some farms, you know, depending on how the animals are handled, and they tend to be on those farms more skittish and nervous around different people and want to stay away from them.
Okay, so now we have to talk about hay, because that's, of course, originally what brought me to you. Why are hay bales different shapes, and why are they different sizes?
Well, primarily you have two types of hay, either dry hay. And when I say dry hay, that's hay that we dry down till it's at least 85% dry matter. And so that when that dry hay is stored, it won't mold, so that the cows won't eat it. And then you also have hay that is baled wet. They're 4x4 round bales. They weigh 1,200 to 1,500 pounds, and they're wrapped in plastic. And you wrap them in plastic so that the bales will ferment.
Why do you want them to ferment?
By wrapping it, you seal out the air. And it's similar to, I think, of making sauerkraut or, you know, pickling vegetables. We're pickling the hay. And then you can, after about 3 weeks, you can feed the bales. They've gone through the fermentation process.
Do the cows like the pickled hay better than the dry hay?
I think it varies from the time of year. When they're first coming off pasture in the fall and early winter, and they're used to eating the green grass, I think they like the bales a little bit wetter. And then as we progress into the winter time and things are getting a little colder, for some reason they seem to like the hay a little bit drier.
About how many pounds of hay a day does a cow eat?
A cow probably eats about, I would say, 20 to 30 pounds of dry matter in hay a day.
That's a lot of chewing.
That's a lot of chewing, and that's important for a cow to chew, because when she's chewing, she's making a lot of saliva. She doesn't have to take antacids, because she's creating all that saliva and buffering her own stomach, and that's really important to keeping her rumen, her four-chambered stomach, really healthy.
So it goes in, it has to come out. How much waste does the cow produce?
I don't know if I could really answer that. You know, some days it seems like an awful lot. It's wonderful in the summertime when they're on pasture. We hardly have to handle any manure at all. And that's the great thing about pasturing, about doing the rotational grazing. They're spreading it themselves. We don't have to haul it out.
And what do you do with all that manure? Does it get composted?
We try to compost the majority of it, especially in the wintertime. We'll mix the manure with waste hay, and we'll bring it out with a dump trailer, and then in the summertime run our compost turner. And while we can't compost, we have a stacking area, and we stack it in there and let it age a little, at least for a few months, and then we'll take that out and spread that on the fields as well.
It's been so much fun talking to you, Jonathan. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Jonathan Gates runs the Howmars Farm in Franklin, Vermont with his family. He's done some blogging and has movies of his cows. Go to our website for the links. You can find us at kcrw.com. So what does a high-end chef do for Thanksgiving? I often wonder myself. Next, I'll ask Mark Peel, the chef owner of Campanile Restaurant, about what's on the table at his house. Maybe we can steal a few ideas. That's when Good Food continues. We're counting down the days to Thanksgiving, and as you struggle with final menu decisions, do you ever wonder what's on the home table of chefs who usually spend their time making us happy? We did. So we invited Mark Peel, chef owner of Campanile, to tell us his personal choices for the holidays. Welcome.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
Let's start, of course, with the turkey. What kind do you use? It used to be that there was no choice. Now there's so much choice.
We're going to use a Willy Bird. It's an organic,
free-range
turkey. We tried to get the heritage turkeys a few years ago, and I understand that they may be back, but they're difficult to get, difficult to size, and very expensive. So the Willy Birds from up in Sonoma County are great. They're consistent, they're delicious, and they're cost-effective.
And do you brine or do you not brine?
Absolutely, we brine. We don't do it traditionally, though. We take the legs off. This makes it so much easier. Take the legs off, brine the whole thing. Then we braise the legs just, you know, in a little bit of turkey broth or chicken broth, something like that. Lots of vegetables, maybe some mushrooms. So they get nice and really tender, really delicious. Then the breast, we after it's been brined, we roast in the oven the usual amount of time.
On the bone.
Absolutely on the bone. Is much juicier that way. Covered with a heap of rosemary. And then when it's done, and it's done much quicker than the traditional turkey because you don't have the legs, you don't have stuffing, we take it outside. Now, that's very important to take it outside because it's going to set off every smoke alarm you've got in the house and turn all the walls a color about a kind of a yellow. And then we light it on fire. We light the rosemary on fire. It gives a great smoky, sweet rosemary aroma to the meat.
Unbelievable. That sounds so good. Let me ask you a couple questions. First of all, we both use the word brining. How do you brine? What is brining? And what proportions do you like to use?
Use a big bucket, something, you know, that will immerse the turkey. And then you have to put it in the refrigerator. So you have to clear a lot of space.
How much salt do you use?
Let's
do you just eyeball
it? No, we don't. I have a formula, and I believe it's for every quart of water, there's a quarter cup of salt and about an eighth of a cup of sugar. When I say salt, that's kosher salt because that's important. Table salt weighs more than kosher salt, so you have to use kosher salt, otherwise it'll be too salty. And then we brine it just the breast overnight. Now, if you take off the legs, it makes it much easier because it really compacts the turkey. So you can brine the legs and the breast all in one container and probably wedge it into your refrigerator as long as you don't have too much of anything else in there.
When you cook the legs, you mentioned the word braising. For people who are not familiar, what is braising?
Well, braising is when it's moist heat. You dry off the legs, sear them in a pan. Nice little bit of brown color. Turn them over. Then put in some onions, some garlic, some carrots, some celery, some parsley, maybe some mushrooms, a little bit of salt, a little bit of pepper, so that it comes up about halfway up on the legs. Okay? And then we cover it with aluminum foil. And in the oven, about an hour, I would say. And then uncover them. There still should be plenty of liquid. And then just leave them in for another 15, 20 minutes to get a nice caramely color on the top. Then they're done. Then you can use that broth that's left over for making your gravy.
So how do you make your gravy?
The gravy, then we strain that. You know, and then take, let it rest, take any fat off the top. Then make a roux. Butter, flour, let's see, what would it be? About a few tablespoons of butter and a few tablespoons of flour. Let's say 3 tablespoons of each would be enough, I would think, if you're just doing one turkey. So you have a quart, maybe 2 quarts of broth.
Broth.
Yeah. Gently sauté the butter and the flour together until it gets just a little bit of straw color to it. And it smells just a how would you call that?
It's so good.
It
almost smells like brown butter.
Almost like brown butter, kind of nutty.
Yeah.
Almondy, like toasted almonds. What I like to do is add the broth that's been strained all at one time, whisk it together really, really well, reduce the heat, and simmer for a long time. And then to make a cream gravy, then you take a little bit of cream, maybe a cup of cream, bring it to a boil on the side, bring it to a simmer, put them together, whisk it really, really well, and then strain it through a fine mesh, and you're done. Then you can add your minced giblets and that you've confit before, of course, right? Or whatever you want to. But that's it. So I want to tell you, I'm working on a new cookbook, just started, and so we finally sat down and measured out what goes into our mashed potatoes.
And was it really shocking to you?
Well, I'll tell you. It's only 5 ingredients. We start off with 2 pounds of russet potatoes, and once they're peeled, it's 1 pound, 12 ounces of potatoes, steamed, and then it's 12 ounces of cream and 12 ounces of butter, and then salt. Oh, that's 4 ingredients. Okay,
no,
so it's 28 pounds. Nope, no pepper. 28 ounces of potato, 24 ounces of cream and butter. I don't know. Maybe people want to sit down and rest their thighs for a minute, moment after hearing that. But that makes great mashed potatoes. Oh, you bring that to Thanksgiving dinner, nobody will ever ask you to make turkey again.
It's true. What about vegetables? Like, do you have any green crunchy things?
Oh, you can't go too far afield with Thanksgiving. Right?
Because people don't like it, right?
You have to hit all those bases. We're doing blue lake beans with cipollini onions and toasted almonds.
What are cipollinis?
Cipollini, those are little flat onions. They look kind of like pearl onions, but they're larger and they look like they've been leaned on. But they're great. They're delicious.
So everybody who's listening to this menu is wondering if you're fully booked already.
We're not yet. We're getting there. Thanksgiving is so much fun because people come in and they have their whole large parties, big families. They're enjoying themselves. And then when they get up, they can walk away from the table, no dishes. We don't advertise this, but I'll tell you, if people want leftovers, they can have them.
Yeah, of course.
Of course. And if you don't have an annoying relative, we'll supply you with one.
Thank you so much, Mark.
Thank you.
Mark Peel is the chef owner of Campanile Restaurant. We've been salivating over Thanksgiving foods. The Good Food Podcast is available each week. Sign up on iTunes to get the download automatically. You can also listen to the archive of this program when you go to kcrw.com. You can sign up for the weekly newsletter, too. Just go to kcrw.com, click on About, and you'll see email newsletters in that list. Jennifer Farrow is the executive producer of Good Food. Today's show was produced by Thea Chaloner, Bob Carlson, Holly Tarson, Candace Moyer, Priya Finnemore, and Marina McLeod. I'm Evan Kleinman. Tune in next week for another edition of Good Food.